Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world is changing, and that won't stop. But what's coming, the big stuff, is hard to predict. Lucky for us, people still have the guts to try. John Brockman, founder of Edge.org, asked over 100 of the world's brightest minds a simple question. What will change everything? What scientific developments in your lifetime will transform the world? We've got their answers this hour on Point. John Brockman on what will change everything. Joining me now from New York is John Brockman, big-time literary agent, author, and founder of the Edge Foundation, which runs the science and technology website Edge.org. Every year, Edge asks scientists and thinkers a big question and publishes the answers in a book, which Brockman edits. The latest, just out, is This Will Change Everything, Ideas That Will Shape the Future. It's based on their 2009 question, and here it is. What game-changing scientific ideas and developments, game-changing, do you expect to live to see? John Brockman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you. 135 or 36 responses here. You know you've got lively thinkers in your circle, and they certainly come out with a heck of a circle of ideas. Here, telepathy and artificial intelligence, free-to-all, colonization of the Milky Way. In their lifetimes, how long do they expect to live?
They are a very unruly bunch, and I don't try to control them. And it's a miracle that we can put this together. I am not the writer of the book. I'm more a producer and organizing disparate minds like this who certainly don't necessarily get along together with each other, and having them wax poetic on their deepest thoughts and feelings is quite an adventure, and it's a thrill for me to do. And I'm really happy to share it with the readers.
Don't need for them to get along to bring this book out, but it is quite a gang. You've got Freeman Dyson, the physicist, and Ian McEwan, novelist, and Craig Venter, the genetics guy, and right on down, Irene Pepperberg with her famous parrot, and you name it.
Alex the parrot. They are all united in the sense that they are science-minded people. In 1991, I appropriated a phrase from C.P. Snow, which is called the third culture. He had written an essay in 62 where he said there's a great divide, his famous two-culture lecture, between the literary people and the science people. And later, in an additional essay, he predicted that literary folks would learn science and communicate it to the people. But that didn't happen. What did happen is scientists and other thinkers, say an Ian McEwan who writes about solar power or neuroscience, who are focused on the empirical world, through their work and their expository writing, are taking the place of the traditional intellectual in rendering visible the deep meanings, who and what we are and how to think about where we are in this world. This was the case 100 years ago when these people wouldn't be called scientists, they'd be called natural philosophers. And if a Charles Darwin wrote a book, it would be read by every serious person in the English language.
So suffice it to say, it's a as you say, unruly bunch. It's a very forward-thinking bunch. And I'm imagining, John, that our listeners are going to be most interested in what they have to say about what big scientific developments or ideas will most change the world in their lifetimes, which, I don't know, I guess that could be anywhere from 20 to 50 to 100 years, depending how long your respondents think they're going to live.
Well, if some of their predictions are true, they'll live forever, but
yes, right.
I'm not betting on it, actually.
You've got Richard Dawkins talking about cross-species breeding, Sam Harris, the End of Faith guy, talking about mind-reading technology, Freeman Dyson
right.
about the direct communications of feelings from brain to brain. What most struck you in this great big pile of predictions?
Well, it's the range, and I do know all these people fairly well. But I'm always surprised at what they're going to come up what they're going to come up with. Marcelo Gleiser, a physicist at Dartmouth, talks about mastering death. Quote, he says, "There's no question more fundamental to us than our mortality. We die and we know it. It's terrifying, inexorable truth, one of the absolute truths we can count on. I can think of two ways which mortality can be tamed, one at the cellular level, the other at the integration of body with genetic and cognitive sciences and cyber technology. I have no question that controlling death is the ultimate human dream. The one thing that can change everything is leading to a deep transformational upheaval that would cause us to have another essay. Meanwhile, I take advice from Shelley's Frankenstein. Perhaps there are things we're truly unprepared for."
So there is a lot of gee whiz stuff in here, but that's not enough. You were looking for things that would really change our sense of life, of the world, change everything.
Right. Well, I would say the really interesting example of that would be an evening where James Watson, who discovered the DNA double helix, and genomics pioneer Craig Venter were jointly awarded a double helix award at Cold Spring Laboratory. For the first two human beings to have their complete genetic information decoded. Watson noted during his acceptance speech that he doesn't want government to be involved in decisions involving how people choose to handle their personal genomics. But Venter was astonishing, letting the word out that he's on the brink of creating the first artificial life form on Earth. He's already announced transplanting the information from one genome into another. In other words, you have two little Petri dishes. You have a little test tube, and you move substance from one to the other, and your dog is now your cat. This is serious business. If he does succeed in creating life, this will be the science announcement to trump any announcements that have ever been made before.
He writes,
and the word is he's very close to it.
He writes here, "We've been reading the genetic code for a few decades, gaining insight, but now," he says, and this is in "This Will Change Everything." Talk about changing everything. "So we can start with digitized genetic information and four bottles of chemicals and write new software of life to direct organisms to do processes that are desperately needed. So maybe creating renewable biofuels or recycling carbon dioxide." J. Craig Venter is saying they in his lifetime, he anticipates that genetics will be put to work doing these really critical things for the planet, John.
And he's actually doing it. He's focusing on not on medical developments, because to succeed at that can take 10, 12, 15 years for various approval processes and millions, if not billions of dollars. So instead, he's focusing on creating energy through synthetic genomics. Exxon announced over the summer they were backing him to the tune of $600 million to build basically farms in which they will grow algae and try to turn it into energy.
You've got Freeman Dyson here, the physicist, talking about his anticipation of radio telepathy, the direct communication of feelings and thoughts from brain to brain, just without speaking.
This is what's called action at a distance, and there's no scientific methodologies that will allow you to do that right now. He's talking about direct feelings, direct communication of feelings and thoughts. He's talking about inventing two technologies to do this. Neural signals and radio signals, and placing microscopic transmitters, receivers in the tissue of a living brain. I think it's Freeman Dyson is one of our greatest thinkers, mm-hmm. and in his later years, he's very proudly a heretical thinker. So I don't know if we're ready to have these implants, but it's certainly an interesting and provocative idea, and it makes people think.
Richard Dawkins, also into genetics here, the sort of famous atheist writer and thinker out of the UK, talking about cross-species breeding, and I'm not sure why.
He's more famous as an evolutionary biologist, mm-hmm. and that's what he's talking about here. Mm-hmm. He's talking about what would change everything is any one of the following. First, discovery of relic populations of extinct hominids such as Homo erectus or Australopithecus. Yeti enthusiasts notwithstanding, I don't think this is going to happen. The world is too well explored for us to overlook the large savanna-dwelling primate. Even Homo florensis has been extinct 17,000 years, but if it did happen, it would change everything. By the way, I apologize. If Dawkins was reading this, it would be like a Shakespearean actor.
Yeah. We've spoken with him. We know, but what's to be gained from cross-species breeding in the mind of Dawkins?
He's not even suggesting it. He's throwing out these possibilities as thought experiments. He thinks there's some enjoyment to be had whenever we're forced to question things we've hitherto never questioned before.
Some would be game-changing in a positive way, others in a negative way. You've got several who are afraid of the explosion of Gerald Holton, Harvard, the explosion of a significant rogue nuclear device. Others talking about, you know, all computers being shut down by nuclear explosion. That would be evolution or devolution of a sort. We're talking this hour about science and ideas that could change everything in our lifetimes. John Brockman edited the new volume. One of those within its pages is Frank Wilczek. He's a professor of physics at MIT. Joins us right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Frank Wilczek, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nobel Prize winning theoretical physicist, and you're saying quantum mechanics could change everything in our lifetimes. Lead us in there, if you would. How? What?
Well, quantum mechanics does and will continue to change everything. Although the theory is about 85 years old, it's actually quite young in terms of our learning to exploit it. It's a whole new world, or rather, we've learned that our world is a much bigger place when examined closely than it appears on the surface. So now we've got the equations that tell us how matter behaves, and thanks to a kind of bootstrap process where using those equations, we design chips and materials and new methods of communication. We get better at solving the equations, and it's just an ascending spiral.
The quantum world all around us, you use a kind of comparison of Columbus poking along the shore of the new world,
yes,
barely understanding it. Here we've got many dimensions, infinite dimensional space around us that you say we're just beginning to probe into, poking along the coast. What's come out of that so far, and what do you see coming out of it down the road, Professor?
Well, what's come out of it so far is the whole world of modern microelectronics, computation, modern methods of communication, lasers, design of different super strong and other materials with special properties, really the whole material substrate of life that we know, and the best is yet to come.
What is coming? How does quantum mechanics make new? I mean, you talk about elevators into space and super strong materials. How does it promise those things? What might come?
Well, the profound fact is that now we have the basic equations that tell us how matter behaves, what it is. So instead of sort of painfully having to assemble materials, perhaps rare materials, and cook them and try different combinations, scattershot, we can be much more systematic, potentially, by just solving the equations and making virtual laboratories that tell us what's possible.
In other words, you can come up with a theoretical material and make it real, make it material. You can sort of write a code for some
first
material we won't find in a mine somewhere.
Well, first see how it's going to behave if you assemble given elements or given materials in whatever way you like, and then see what works And then you know what the target is, and once you know what the target is, you can go after it.
How do you get from quantum mechanics to an elevator into space?
Well, the main barrier to getting an elevator into space is the strength of materials. We need a material that's capable of supporting its own weight off to the distance it takes to get from the surface of the Earth into regions where the gravity field is small. And there are known materials that are almost there. And what we need is ways of assembling them better or slightly different materials, maybe putting in the right kinds of impurities or cooking them the right way. That would take us from close to the limit or just over the limit to the realm of what's practical.
You also write about quantum mechanics as perhaps being the path to solving the big energy problem we have on Earth right now.
Well, that's another case where we're close, and then the essential problems are materials problems. If we had materials that we could use to make slightly better photovoltaic cells that capture energy a bit more efficiently and produce them on a mass scale at a reasonable cost, the energy landscape would look completely different from what it looks like today, and there would be a whole new economy would be much wealthier and much more sustainable than what we have today. So the thing I want to emphasize is that we're not all that far, and I think there's this possibility of an ascending spiral whereby learning to use the theory better, we design materials that allow better computation, better communication, and perhaps a worldwide network of computers working on these problems to design still better materials, and it just takes off.
John Brockman, Frank Wilczek starts talking quantum mechanics, and pretty soon you can see a kind of remade world.
Absolutely. There's a hidden gem in Frank's response that I would like to ask him about.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the exaflop frontier.
Mm-hmm.
That could be next year's question. What is the exaflop frontier?
human
brains on steroids.
You're talking about supercomputing capacity.
Yes.
He's also talking about how we create tools and then we mold ourselves by our use of them. We become the tools. You have to imagine these things first, and that's part of what this exercise is about.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists... create these, scientists create technology using new tools. We become the technology, and the point of this particular question is that until very recently, maybe 20 years ago, no democratic populace, no legislative body ever indicated by choice, by vote, how the process should be played out. Nobody voted for printing. Nobody voted for electricity. Nobody voted for radio, telephone, automobile, airplane, television, mm-hmm. penicillin, the pill. Nobody voted for space travel, massively parallel computing, nuclear power.
But we got them.
Google, internet.
Yeah.
It's true. And so government just plays catch up. They're always caught short. And in a sense, Frank and his pals are the de facto legislators. For better or worse, and for the most part, all of them that I know are high-minded and want the best. However, we are a democracy, and I value Frank and his friends for the quality of the questions they're asking. At the end of the day, normal people like Tom and myself need to learn about these things and vote.
Yes.
Frank Wilczek, I may ask on that front, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher at Tufts, writes an intro here where he writes about the sort of what increasingly looks like this very, very malleable reality of ours, almost like we could push it in lots of different directions. There is an element of choice here. Do you want the democracy leaning over your shoulder saying, hey, Frank, we don't want a space elevator. We want a super solar array?
Well, it doesn't have to be either or. Let me backtrack a little bit. First of all, I think one should recognize that actually government support has been historically and still is crucial to supporting these kinds of very long-term research efforts. The real origin of the Internet was the ARPANET, which was a Defense Department project, to make sure that communications would remain viable in the event of a nuclear catastrophe. And I think in many of the cases that John mentioned, you could trace back the early seeds of the project to pure research efforts that were unclear in where they were going, but just giving money to people who you trust to be smart and curious and work hard and push things turns out to be a great investment. So I hope the government and people will continue to support that.
Frank Wilczek,
and then we'll give them lots of choices and for what technologies to use or not, and that where the people speak, and I think our job is to present them with choices, and then the democratic process, both in the sense of voting and also people voting with their money, making economic choices, comes in.
We've got the people wanting to speak right now, Frank and John, if I may. A lot of people, callers here, want to join the conversation. We've got 100-plus ideas in John Brockman's book, This Will Change Everything. Jake in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Jake, you're on the air with Nobel Prize-winning physicist Frank Wilczek and with John Brockman. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Well, my comment is about, you know, since the beginning of, say, Hollywood productions, writers have always imagined our future and the technology that it imposed. And very rarely are these predictions about, you know, the human evolving that far. It's more about our technology. So that's more about what my question is. There was a recent movie called I Am Legend. I'm not sure if any of your guests or you have seen it, but I'm sure a lot of the listeners have.
Yeah.
In this movie, there's a retrovirus that's refitted to aid and cure cancer, is how they showed it. Is this a realistic de-evolution of something that we could create in technology that could affect us biologically? So my question is, maybe, you know, we keep talking about how it would be advances that would help us. Maybe it would be an advance that could be our demise or close to it.
In I Am Legend, the retrovirus turns people into zombies or something like that, if I recall, Jake, right?
Well, yeah, roughly. You know, there could be something biological. We're tinkering around with a lot of biology, a lot of genetics, and, you know, I'm for a lot of it. But, you know, it could come back to bite us in our keister, so to say.
Let me go to our physicist first on that. Frank Wilczek, what about the odds that the breakthroughs we get will be positive as opposed to the opposite?
Well, I'm optimistic. The breakthroughs for sure are empowering. Now, power can be used for good or ill. But I guess maybe I'm naive, but I'm optimistic about the choices people will make, and that more power will lead to better lives.
John Brockman, what about the
it's
balance of...
It's possible to make mistakes, though.
Yes,
and
yeah,
we have to pay attention.
and
scientists should be sure, you know, when they unleash these things, that they maximize the probability that people will use them wisely.
We've got accidental nuclear war and deliberate rogue nuclear device explosion, John, among your 100-plus projections here.
We also had two kids 10 years ago bring down the record industry with Napster.
I don't know if that's good or bad.
That kind of thing, two kids in a garage fooling around with synthetic genomics, could come up with something as well. We don't know. I'm optimistic as well, but Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society and a very distinguished cosmologist, did a book called Our 50-50 Chance of Survival, talking about the next century. It is a concern, and that's why you do need adults overlooking what's going on in these areas. But as I said, I am optimistic. And
I think what John is doing and what you're doing, Tom, here is very, very important in this process, that people be aware of the possibilities.
Great point. And be and educate themselves.
Yes.
To say, to be able to intelligently know how to have an opinion, because it's a big issue in this country, which some recent network news report had America 21st in science test scores in high school around the world.
Get it out there, air it out there, and get an education. Let's hear from those Americans. Charlotte, North Carolina. Keith, you're on the air, Keith.
Hello.
Hi, Keith, you're on.
Okay, actually, I think the discovery of water on the moon, I think that's going to change a lot. I really think that we're going to start having have a leap pad into space soon.
This from the recent NASA expedition there that they're saying, says there's water there. And do you expect in your lifetime significant space exploration beyond the moon, Keith?
Actually I do. I believe hopefully the people are going to be a little bit more galvanized towards exploring space and destroying the world or destroying other people. So,
Keith, let us look at it while we've got a Nobel Prize winning physicist. Frank, within your quantum mechanics vision, what does it mean for space exploration beyond the elevator, maybe?
Well, I think right now there are easier ways to make progress than moving with current technology men into space. It's an important direction, but I think there are other directions that in the near future are more promising. However, I think the long-term prospect is that when we understand materials better, we have ways of getting the first difficult step of getting off Earth into low gravity regions under control and can travel through space more cheaply, perhaps with man-machine hybrids as opposed to delicate human bodies, then will be the time to really make a big move into space.
Man-machine hybrids, we've got everything on the table here. John Brockman, you've got space explorers who want to get all the way out in the Milky Way among your respondents.
I don't want to go to Europe. I don't know what Frank's talking about.
But it's very much on the minds of, you can hear Keith thinking about it. You've got writers and thinkers here thinking about it.
Well, Gerard K. O'Neill, a colleague, the late Gerard O'Neill, talked about space colonies about 30, 40 years ago. And those visions are very prominent. The XPRIZE, run by Peter Diamandis, is arranging people to go live in space habitats. If people can do it technologically, they will. And we'll see what happens from it.
People want to get in on this. Brian in Boston, you're on the air, Brian.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have seen much talk on the internet and in certain magazines about the company out of New Jersey, Blacklight, and the claims of the researchers down there to have lowered the ground state of the hydrogen atom, and during the through this process, it throws off a tremendous amount of heat and energy, and you know, evidently there's been numerous validations of the process, including recent spectral analysis by Rowan University, and I'm just wondering if you know anything further about this.
Would it be an energy source then, Brian? Is that the point?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, during the according to what I've read, during the transition from the current ground state of the hydrogen atom down into a lower ground state, it throws off just tremendous amounts of energy during the transition, and
yeah, it sounds fascinating. John Brockman, what do you say?
I'm saying get on the phone and get Frank Wilczek back here.
Yeah, right. Bring in our physicist.
That's beyond my pay grade.
But lowering the ground state of hydrogen, I mean, everybody's thinking about energy, and a lot of the ideas that you've collected in your 100-plus are certainly focused on that front. Brian brings us another. Let's go to Newport News, Virginia, and Robin. Robin, you're on the air.
Yes, I think the mapping of the human brain to understand our impulses, violent impulses in particular, or angry impulses that lead to violent action, is the wave of the future. That early childhood educators could actually educate a whole generation of people who didn't, murder or harm people or harm themselves or really understanding the brain.
Thank you, Robin. John, you've got Carl Sabag in the book, writer, television producer, talking about the end of harm. And right on this front, he says, in the brains of everyone from abusive parents and rapists to arms dealers and heads of state, there can arise a concatenation of nerve impulses which allow someone to see as normal the mutilation, maiming, death of another for one's own pleasure, or greed, or benefit. He, too, wants to change that, like Robin.
It's interesting. I do think this is a portent for the future, but you could also say there are people out there that mean harm to others that would use this as a technique, rather than a way of
mind control instead of ending harm.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're training 12-year-olds to be suicide bombers, what would stop you from turning this against people and their well-being rather than trying to aid them?
There's always that light and dark. You've got Irene Pepperberg in the book, a psychologist at Harvard, talking about mastery of the brain. Knowledge of exactly how the brain works will change everything. She writes, we will, for example, ameliorate diseases in which the brain stops working properly, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and right on down. Karen in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Karen.
Thank you. There's someone missing from all of this, and that's someone who speaks with the voice that says, no matter what science and technology we have, we still are ourselves. And the person who brought it to my thought was thinking of the combination of species. Someone's already projected that out, and it's Margaret Atwood, who wrote Oryx and Crake, and whose book The Year of the Flood is now on the bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole conversation is so out of balance. So deep
out of balance in what dimension, Karen?
Humility. No humility at all. We're driven, or these folks are driven to use the words mastery and control and dominance and, you know, all of those. And Margaret Atwood is just the most subversive and funny and heartbreaking author. And I'm thinking of two guys in the garage. Well, her boys in Oryx and Crake were two boys in the garage, and they ended the world.
Are you thinking it's a guy thing?
I wish it only was, but it may be. In fact, it certainly is out of balance. Guys are fine. Masculine energy is fine. All of it is a wonderful gift, but it is so drastically out of balance. Just look around.
You know, I want to respond to that by inviting in another of the great thinkers that John Brockman's collected in This Will Change Everything, Allison, and thank you for your call. Allison Gopnik joins us from Berkeley, California. She's professor of psychology, affiliate professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley, expert on cognitive and language development, author of The Philosophical Baby. Allison Gopnik, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And we want to talk about the sort of childlike plasticity of mind that you're seeing emerging in this century. But if we could, if you heard a bit of our last caller's comment first, is there a gender flavor to the frontiers of science? And is that a problem?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that, of course, all of these writers are saying this is what could happen. Whether it actually does happen or not depends on all the decisions that we make as citizens and policymakers. So I don't think it's necessarily true that any of these developments are going to happen or going to be for good or bad unless we decide that they're going to. I think there are some differences in the kinds of things that people are interested in and the kinds of things that people pay attention to based on their experience. So for me, for example, and I think for others, early childhood, children, that's a frontier that hasn't been explored as much and that we're just really starting to understand.
The headline that John Brockman gives you for your world-changing development is Never-Ending Childhood. Where are you pointing with that, Allison?
Well, the idea is that when you look at childhood, there seems to be a kind of division of labor between children and adults. So children in our human childhood seems to be a time when we're protected from the immediate demands of the world so that we can learn everything that we need to learn and understand about the world around us. And as we get older, we shift from this early period when we're very open to learning everything and not very good at doing anything to a later period where we're very good at doing specific things, very good at actually implementing and being executives, but not as good at being flexible and learning new things. And we even know something about the brain changes that are responsible for this shift. I say that babies are the research and development department of the human species, and we adults are production and marketing. Now, what's happened, even in the last 100 years, is that that period of childhood, that period when we're immature and we can't take care of ourselves, but we're incredibly good at learning new things, seems to have been extended longer and longer. So as we spend more and more time in school, for example, whereas in the past, by the time we were 14 or 15, we were out doing the kinds of useful things that we would continue to do. Now we can be 30 or 35 and still be in school. And I think that's a very, very basic change to the way that we function. My guess is that as information and learning and knowledge become more and more important to us, that period is going to get extended further and further. Now, we do it already by having people spend a longer and longer time in school and longer period before they get married, before they have children, before they're out into being independent. But in the future, as we start to understand things like the brain basis of this change, we might be manipulating it by genetic or chemical changes as well.
You say we may remain children forever or at least much longer, and in an information age, that pliability of plasticity of mind may be vital. But who gets the work done in that picture, Alison Gopnik?
Well, that's the trouble. The kind of evolutionary picture seems to be that there's a kind of trade-off between the kind of brain and mind you need to be able to learn lots and lots of new things, to be able to explore lots of possibilities, to be open to the entire world, and the kind of brain you need to narrow and hone in and effectively get the job done. It's as if there's a kind of intrinsic trade-off between some people call exploring and exploiting the world, or at least exploring and executing. And the worry would be that as we emphasize exploring and learning and knowing more and more, we see a generation that's having a harder time actually getting things done. And again, we know a little bit about the cognitive basis for this. So the question is, if all of us are children for longer and longer, who's going to be the grown-ups? Who's going to actually take care of those children?
Well, John, a lot of your respondents talk about much longer life. Maybe there's a kind of balance emerging here.
Right, and I look at this exercise, what we're doing in this book, is almost a childlike endeavor where we're learning, we're thinking. It's not a bunch of adults making pompous pronouncements, telling people this is what will be. It's letting people in on their deepest, most meaningful thoughts. And a lot of these people are octogenarians. I look at EDGE.org as a university, and I think I'm the only student, and it's a wonderful education. So it's a different way of looking at the world, and as the economy moves more and more to information services, I think this is a very good thing.
A childhood that may last forever or a lot longer. Alison Gopnik, please stand by there in California. Let's get a call from Eben in Patton, Vermont. Eben, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was fortunate enough to spend 2 weeks with a very good friend of mine who's a distinguished scientist at Stanford. We spent 2 weeks in Hawaii over the holidays.
Lucky you.
And it was wonderful. But we have these wonderful discussions. I'm a sculptor. He's a very distinguished scientist. And we're always battling. And to the end of to describe our discussion where it sort of leaves off, is he ends up accusing me of being, a caveman. And I end up accusing him of essentially trying to put scientific band-aids on what I see as a sinking ship, a societal sinking ship. I also, over the vacation, read Daniel Quinn's Ishmael, which is a deep philosophical look at laws of physics and also laws of society. And I would say that my scientific friend and I came to two conclusions. Number one, that overpopulation is a massive problem, and I would love to hear some discussion of how that could be worked into a science solving. And the other thing was that science itself needs to be fairly represent in media, and no longer it's so contaminated by misinformation and religious agenda that we really need to, especially in America, where I see it's very dangerous how many people don't believe in Darwinism and don't believe in fundamental scientific things. That he and I both share a concern, a very common ground, that this discussion is so muddled, and that if scientists could unite on that alone, we would then be able to have an educated society that could accurately discuss what our real problem.
Eben, you put a lot on the table from your Hawaiian beach. Let us turn to it, and maybe first of all to just this notion of there's all these great ideas and scientific potential developments here. Allison, let me put it to you. You probably thumbed through some of these. Do these look like Band-Aids on a sinking ship, or game changers that might surface that ship?
Well, let me go back to the idea about this developmental trade-off. So, as John said, what these scientists are doing is acting in a very childlike way, and in some ways, in fact, I've said that it's not so much that children are like little scientists, it's that scientists are big children. We're exploring and learning and knowing. The other thing that we have to do is actually decide what things are the best ones to do and how to do them, and that's a different set of skills. That's a different set of decisions. So I think it's important that we have both. It's important that we know and we understand and that everybody know and understand, because knowledge and information is going to be the currency of the future. It's also important that we have institutions that can take that knowledge and information and actually put them to work, sort of the way each individual person does when they take the amazing things that they discover as children and put them into work in their life as adults. We have to do that as a society as a whole. We have to take all those childlike scientific curiosity and discovery and learning and all appreciate it and combine it with an effective way of running our world.
John Brockman, have your respondents looked at the human population here as a problem or as just neighbors? Is overpopulation something that's heavily considered?
There have been debates among scientists for the last 20 years about the effects of population. It seems with the current discussions about global warming and the fact that there may be 9 billion people on the planet in 20 years, it's becoming more to the front. On the other hand, a number of the, let us say, the techno-determinist types think that technologies are going to come along that will create a world of abundance. For example, if the second part of Frank Wilczek's notions of new kind of
energy production from quantum
energy production comes about, it will change everything. If Venter is successful, it will change everything. We're not going to be dependent on Middle Eastern oil. We'll be able to grow our own fuel. We'll be completely energy efficient. So things will be different. So, my typical response on this is nobody knows and you can't find out, but we will.
Not everybody has childlike optimism here. Brian Eno, the musician and producer, writes in the collection about the end of optimism. Human development thus far has been fueled and guided by the feeling that things could be and probably are going to be better, he writes, but suppose that feeling changes. Survivalism rules. Might will be right. Oh, boy. Allison, that sounds terrifying.
Well, one thing we know is that from psychology is that optimism is very, very deeply built into our human nature. And one of the things about us as human beings is that we can envision all these alternative possibilities in the way the world could be. For children, that comes with their imagination and their pretend and their play. With adults, it comes when we do an exercise like doing science. And it's because we can imagine all these possible ways that the world could be, and sometimes we can actually make the world be that way, that I think a kind of fundamental optimism is very, very deeply built into our human nature. Things would have to get pretty bad for us to lose that.
But you write that brains themselves are changing as our environment changes.
Well, of course, one of the big frontiers is going to be that as we understand more about how the mind and brain work, we can not only do things to change the world around us, but we can actually start doing things to change the way our own minds and brains work. Again, to some ways, we've always been doing that. After all, school is really a very advanced technology for changing people's minds and brains. But as we get more and more tools, we'll be doing that more and more. And I think that's certainly going to be one of the most exciting and disturbing and dangerous and potentially beneficial frontiers ahead of us as we go on.
Well, that's a pretty good assessment of the future. It's all that. Allison Gopnik at UC Berkeley, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, happy to be with you.
John Brockman, give us a homework assignment. Your question for the year ahead. You've just got 10 seconds here.
How has the Internet changing the way you think?
How is the Internet changing the way you think?
And if you go to www.edge.org, you'll see 160 answers.
This Will Change Everything is the book right now. John Brockman, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.